This is BBC Radio 4 FM, where now we continue with our book of the week, Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole. Clinical neurologist Alan Roper visits two cases where answers to the patient's problems were not the obvious ones.
On the 3rd of July, a day after a routine colonoscopy, Vincent Talma was playing right field in a company softball game. A short, intense man with thick gray hair and a perpetual scowl, he did not look as though he was having fun. When he disagreed with a call by the umpire, he would throw up his arms in disbelief, kick the dirt, and swear under his breath, not for show or for the approbation of his teammates, but out of real anger and disgust. As the game wound into the late innings, Vincent's behavior began to change, subtly at first, then dramatically. By the time he was dropped off at his house, his wife was startled to see a bemused look on his face, an air of innocence in place of his usual gruffness. He gave one-word answers to her questions, avoided eye contact, and seemed quite unlike himself. He was smiling too much. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Sure, fine," he replied. "Did you win?" "Fine, yes." "Did something happen?" "Fine." The more she persisted, the more Vincent perseverated. "Did anything happen at the game?" "Fine, yeah, fine," he mumbled with a sheepish smile. His wife called her primary care physician, who told her to get him to the emergency room immediately. "Vincent, we need to go," she said. "Fine, okay." At East Shore Hospital, an MRI showed an ambiguous blotch on the left frontal lobe of Vincent's brain. And at the suggestion of one of his sons, a pediatrician, the family requested a transfer to us. He arrived sometime around 10 o'clock that morning and was brought up to the ward. A week earlier, Cindy Song, a sophomore at Boston College, had started acting a bit withdrawn. Her roommate was concerned enough to call Cindy's sister. "Not a big deal," the sister said. "She gets that way. She'll be okay." By morning, Cindy wouldn't leave her room and would not or could not tell her roommate why. Alternately anxious and distracted, she spent the day in bed. That evening, she refused to eat, and her roommate made the second call, this one to Cindy's mother, a first-generation Korean immigrant. Cindy's mother took the next commuter train from Framingham. When she got to Cindy's room and sat down in front of her daughter, all she got back was a blank stare focused on the wall behind her. Her daughter's eyes were wide open and her pupils dilated. She was shivering mildly and sweating all over. Finally, she spoke. "Mom, they've been after me for weeks, creeping in through the cinder blocks, taking my clothes off. Can't you see them?" Like all universities, Boston College has a health center that provides minimal services overnight, relying on referrals to local emergency rooms for anything serious. The after-hours nurse, who was used to such things, assumed that Cindy had been using recreational drugs and was just flipping out. Nothing unusual as far as the nurse was concerned. But Cindy's mother was outraged. Convinced simply from cultural experience that there were no drugs involved, she would not let that stand. Cindy was so jittery and sweaty that the nurse gave in and called an ambulance to take her to the Brookline Hospital emergency room. Once there, Cindy remained agitated, stopped responding to questions, and started thrashing as though reacting to hallucinated visions. This prompted a round of phone calls to the 8 local psychiatric hospitals to see if there was a bed for an acutely psychotic young woman. As daylight broke, Cindy was close to berserk. Her arms had to be restrained with straps, and she was soaking up tranquilizers like a sponge. Finally, the ambulance came to take her to the psychiatric hospital. After a short interlude of relative calm, the nurses became alarmed when Cindy's jitteriness escalated into full-blown myoclonus, arms and legs flinging up off the bed, her head jerking back violently. Her pupils were huge. If it had been a drug overdose, they realized, this would have abated by now. "I got a call about 9:30 a.m. "You'd better send her over," I said. Every one of our patients has, in effect, fallen into a hole, and it's our job to get them out again. In Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Alice jumps into a rabbit hole and finds herself in a bizarre realm in which nothing is what it seems. We treat people with seemingly implausible ailments all of the time. Each day they show up in a parade of signs, symptoms, and diseases. That's how the residents refer to the cases, as in, "Let's go see the basilar thrombosis on 10 East." After the bedside visit, the thrombosis suddenly has a name. The glioma has a wife and children. And the man for whom a smile was a troubling symptom owns 6 wireless stores. "Good morning, Mr. Talma," Hannah said. "Do you remember me?"
"Yes, good, fine," Vincent replied.
He was sitting up in bed watching television with a smile of bemused innocence. Vincent Talma was a picture of contentment. Along with 29 of our other patients, he had been waiting for a visit from the neurology team on their morning speed rounds. Hannah was in charge. Her service, the culmination of 3 years as a neurological resident, had started a week before I came on board. A service involves running the neurology inpatient ward, admitting and discharging the patients, and directing a team consisting of 3 junior residents, 2 medical students, and a physician's assistant. My colleagues and I had some doubts about Hannah when she first came to the program. The most superficial of these doubts focused on her style of dress. In a profession where sartorial flair is an unexpected and somewhat suspect concept, Hannah's clogs, leggings, and wraps seemed needlessly exotic. Perhaps even more alienating was the fact that Hannah did not drive a car, and instead rode her bike from her apartment in Boston's North End to the Brigham, usually well before the sun rose, or long after it had set, in any kind of weather, short of a blizzard. Such stoicism flew in the face of the unhealthy lifestyle adopted by most of the residents, who tend to favor pastries over granola, Coke over water, and elevators over stairs. I could see that over the course of the previous week, Hannah had begun the transition from resident to full-fledged physician. I could see it in her bearing, in the firmness of her tone with some of the more difficult patients, and in the controlled sympathy she adopted in family meetings when she had to deliver bad news. She had turned out to be one of our strongest clinicians. "What are you watching?" Hannah asked Vincent.
"The bunkers."
"Do you mean All in the Family?"
Yes, the bunk... Yes."
Vincent's form of speech difficulty, known as Wernicke's aphasia, sounds like gibberish, but not pure nonsense. It can include halting phrases that almost make sense, echolalia, repeating someone else's just-used words, and perseveration, giving the same answer to a succession of different questions. "What's your name?" Hannah said.
"Vincent."
"Good. Where are we? What place is this?"
"Vincent?"
Yeah.
"Vince."
"What day is it?"
"Vince. Vince."
Gilbert, the medical student who had made the initial exam, recorded this as orientation times one.
"To one what?" I later asked him.
"To himself," he said.
"Have you ever met a patient who wasn't?"
"I don't think so."
"No, you haven't. It doesn't exist."
The phrase A and O times three means awake, oriented to self, oriented to place, and oriented to time. Some people add a fourth, oriented to situation. The problem is that everybody is oriented times one, unless they are hysterical or dead. Vincent knew who he was. He was sharp enough to find himself amusing. Did his colonoscopy earlier in the week bring this on? Or, more to the point, did the anesthesia bring it on? My guess is that it was just a coincidence. A straw poll of the team leaned toward a diagnosis of tumor, possibly stroke, maybe a seizure. But they were basing their guesses on Vincent's MRI. I had seen the scans and knew they did not hold the answer. On the other hand, Vincent's wife, who was sitting in an armchair at the foot of his bed, did. "He had a bad headache from the beginning," she told me,
and a fever. The residents had neglected to mention this, but it was important. "How about a virus?" I suggested. Herpes encephalitis was my hunch. It would connect the headache and low-grade fever, neither of which fit with a tumor or a stroke. "Ignore the scan for now," I told Hannah. "When there's nothing obvious there, it can be a distraction. Stick with the patient's story and the bedside exam." We started him on an antiviral medication, and he soon improved. 5 days later, Vincent was discharged, talking normally again, and, for better or worse, just like his old self. I told his wife that if he started being nice to her again, she should bring him back immediately. I was out on the ward at about 9:30 that morning when the call about Cindy's song arrived from the other hospital. "Is she salivating like she has rabies?" That was my first question and would turn out to be my only one. "Yes, like a dog," was the reply. "It's an ovarian teratoma," I said. "You better send her over." It was a snap diagnosis, possibly wrong, but there was no harm in raising on a pair of aces. The drooling alone was a tip-off. A teratoma is an unusual tumor that contains cells from the brain, teeth, hair, skin, and bone. Most teratomas are harmless, but they have the potential to wreak havoc by causing encephalitis. When you see it, the syndrome is unmistakable. An ovarian teratoma stimulates an antibody that will produce the very ensemble of symptoms that were described to me over the phone. 2 hours later, when she was wheeled into the ICU, the intensive care unit, Cindy looked toxically ill, with a heart rate of 135 beats per minute and blood pressure of 160 over 90. She was sweating, salivating, and shivering wildly. Her eyes were wide open, but she was entirely unresponsive. Joelle, the senior ICU resident, Hannah's counterpart down on the ninth floor, immediately intubated her. The toxicology screen from the other hospital was negative. So I called the gynecology service to get an emergency ultrasound of Cindy's pelvis. They thought I was crazy. "Remove her ovary?" the gynecologist said. "Right. Do you see that cyst on the ultrasound? It's not so benign." This was a rare, rare thing. No one fully understands it, but I know it clinically when I see it, or even hear it over the phone, because I collect arcana. It took a bit of cajoling, but in the end, they removed her ovary. The sweating, the salivating, and the wild swings in blood pressure were gone within hours. Her psychosis resolved within days. Alice in Wonderland is an absurd story beyond fantasy. That's neurology in a nutshell. Your patient disappears down a rabbit hole. You've got to do something. You can't just sit there. So, you go down the hole after the patient. Sometimes you can do it right away. You go to the gynecologist and say, "Take out her ovary." And that gets her out of the hole. It may not get her back out the same hole she went in, but in a case like Cindy Song's, it gets her out relatively quickly. Same with Vincent Talma. We brought him out. Not quite as good as new, with a slight speech deficit that most people wouldn't even notice, but we got him out.
Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole was written by Alan Roper and Brian Burrell. It was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Colin Stinton. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. And you might like to know that Alan Roper will be the guest on Radio 3's Free Thinking programme. That's tonight at 10 o'clock.
The wonderful thing with the BBC Food and Farming Awards is that we got this phone call out of the blue to say, somebody local to you has nominated you.
If you do not nominate your local baker or your local butcher, they're not going to be able to be judged. And that's where it really comes from the heart.
There are so many unsung heroes within kitchens, whether it be from a school to a hospital or a prison.
Find out how you can nominate the people who care about what we eat. Search online for the 2015 Food and Farming Awards.